of the Ways and Means Committee, and we will open as a subcommittee to have public hearing on House Bill 2431A, which relates to scholarships for former foster children. And I don't see Representative Shetterly here, Senator Duncan. Yeah. And so we'll start with Steve at the bottom of the list. Not that you're at the bottom, but.
Yeah, well, not the bottom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Today you have a public hearing and work session scheduled on House Bill 2431. I have prepared a handout for you, which is all stapled together, so everything's in one piece, with the yellow sheet on top to explain what this bill does. What this bill, by the way, does come to you from the House Committee on School Achievement and School Accountability, where it received unanimous support from all members who were voting on the bill. The bill would establish a full tuition scholarship program for former foster children, and it sets eligibility as being for students who have been in foster care for at least 1 year while they were between the ages of 16 and 21. Eligible students must enroll within 3 years of high school graduation or within 3 years of leaving foster care, whichever is earlier. The bill would award scholarships if the students are enrolled in an Oregon public or private university or college or a community college in Oregon. The bill sets the scholarship level equal to the actual tuition and fees, except for students in the private colleges who wouldn't receive more than or would not receive more than the fee level at the University of Oregon. The bill places the administration of the scholarship program with the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. It declares an emergency and makes scholarships available beginning for the school year that starts in the fall. It establishes a fund to hold the scholarship monies and allows the Oregon Investment Council to manage these funds. And finally, it appropriates $150,000 of general fund for scholarships. You also have in this packet of materials the next page that's stapled right behind the yellow page are the House Bill 2431-A2 amendments, which eliminate general fund appropriation but allow the fund to receive appropriations, if they do become available, donations and grants for the scholarship program. And that is actually the amendments that the co-chairs are asking you to consider if you do pass this bill out, because at this point there hasn't been the $150,000 identified for the program as of now.
Thank you, Steve. Representative Shetterly, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
You know what we're talking about?
I do. Yeah. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Lane Shetterly, State Representative, District 34. I'll be brief just to commend the bill to you. I think the policy is unassailable. The opportunity that this presents to help kids who have probably had tough lives to step up and move beyond a beginning that may be tough to overcome by giving them the chance to get a higher education and advance themselves and their circumstances. I'm disappointed to hear the report from staff regarding the -A2 amendments and the recommendations of the co-chairs. For $150,000, I think this is a lot of bang for the buck that we can get out of this bill and the improvements that it can make in kids' lives. And I would urge you, I don't pretend to know the ins and outs of your Ways and Means Committee process. Thankfully, I've been immune from that for all these sessions that I have served. But I would advocate very strongly for a general fund appropriation to get this started. I think it does not put a program on very good footing for drawing other funds when the state says, yeah, we like it, but we're not going to put any money behind it. I think that some general fund appropriation to get this off the ground and to move it forward in a productive way is really critical. And so I would urge your favorable consideration of the bill with the appropriation, or at least some level of appropriation, to make it a meaningful beginning and say that we really do support this.
Thank you, Lane, very much. And if we do adopt the Dash 2 amendments, we still have the opportunity when we get to add backs on all these education.
I appreciate that. I mean, I do. I say I understand that.
I know there's a lot of support on this committee to do that. And as you probably know, it's, we follow the recommendations of the co-chairs.
I understand that. And I want my comments on the record, and I do understand the add back process. By the same token, of course, I want to remain a strong advocate for it, for funding to keep this thing moving forward. And I guess at this point, anything we can get to keep the bill alive and in the process, so that if money falls off the table, it will fall into this bill. I'll take that better than an up or down vote on the bill. That's for sure.
Thank you, Senator Tro.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Shetterly, I heard about this bill. Belatedly, but I was really glad to hear about it, and I heard it because a constituent of mine, Carly Davis, called and was very excited about the bill and very pleased that it had been introduced and thought it was a fine idea. She did have some suggestions to extend it so that other foster children would qualify as well as those that you have qualified. Suggestions I think that she makes is that maybe the age requirement be taken out and that it be extended to others who have been foster children earlier in life, and because they too could benefit from this. She suggests maybe using as a way of describing foster children those so identified by the Internal Revenue Service as foster children. And that would be a broader category. Not all of those folks would be thinking about going on to college and would use it, but it would open it up for more. What are your thoughts about that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Tro, I don't have particularly strong feelings about that, other than to say that the bill was drafted in careful consultation pre-session with Adam Cornell, and the Juvenile Rights Project, Mr. Cornell himself being a former foster child. And I guess I'm inclined to leave it to them to make a final evaluation of that, because I do know they were very careful in how they put this bill together. The other thing I would say about it is that if we are going to have trouble putting general fund dollars, or if it's going to be a close call getting the general fund appropriation in the first place, I'm not sure what the point is, particularly in expanding it, but again, I'll leave that to the committee. I don't have a real strong feeling, other than that I would be interested to hear what the requesters of the bill might have to say about that proposed amendment.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
And Representative Shetterly, you know, clearly I think if it's good for some small group of foster children, it's good for all of them. It might be so categorized. Question is, you know, what can we afford, what can we get passed, and so forth. If it's limited as we pass it this time, there's no reason why we couldn't come back to the concept in another biennium and suggest that it be expanded.
Mr. Chair, Senator Tro, absolutely not. Again, in consultation with the requesters, I'm not familiar enough with this particular area in terms of definitions and scope to feel comfortable to tell you that, yeah, it's just the right thing to do. I don't have any particular problem with it, but neither do I have enough familiarity with it to say, yeah, do it. And so that's why I'm really deferring to the requesters more than anything else on the issue of the amendment. And certainly, if we don't have the time or opportunity to evaluate and make that call this session, you're absolutely right. We can come back and do that again. I think the most important thing really at this point is to keep the bill moving forward so that we can try and get some general fund appropriation in there to get the program going, and then we can expand the program once we have that in place, if that's what we need to do as a second step.
Thank you. Other questions or comments? Yes, Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Shetterly, do these students still qualify for the need-based scholarship?
Yes, they do, Mr. Chair, Representative Kloss.
So why would we need to make an additional category if they already qualify as low income?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kloss, I think probably the best answer to that is the need-based scholarship program doesn't begin to cover all the students that are already eligible for it. I think this is a way to carve out some that qualify under a particular criteria. And in doing that, if we're able to put funds into that, we're effectively going to expand the need-based scholarship program.
Did you have anything to say about that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Close, I also mentioned that these scholarships would be of a larger size than the need grant.
Good point.
Because, or the opportunity grant, because they would be full tuition scholarships.
Other questions or comments for the representative?
All right,
Lane, thank you very much.
Thank you for your consideration. Have a good morning.
All right. We will have Senator Duncan will be here in a moment, but if we could move along, Lisa Ann Kay, please, and if you don't mind being interrupted when the Senator comes, well, we would appreciate that. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you for having me, Senator Hartung, members of the committee. I am Lisa Kay. I am an attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project, and I certainly don't mind being interrupted.
And you are
now the time.
Right now. Senator Duncan, please come forward and tell us what we should know about this bill. No, she had just introduced herself, and I forewarned her that you would be showing up. So. Welcome to the committee.
Well, certainly a pleasure to be with you folks today, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I just want to add my support for... Are you on the amendment right now?
We have talked about the amendment. Representative Shetterly just gave the broad concept. And
okay. Well, I recognize that there is a money problem, and that probably the kind of thing I'd love to see happen probably won't happen this particular time. But a lot of work has been done on this bill, and when you look at the merits of the bill, it's really the proper thing to do. We're talking about young people who are wards of the state. They don't get the backing of parents and grandparents and so forth as so many other young people do as they move on to colleges, universities, and other academic work. And it does seem appropriate that the state is the parent in that case and should be providing a parent kind of a role. What I think this amendment does, it gets it in on the books. It does establish a foundation so that other grants, other mechanisms can be made available for them to receive money and to get a start. And my hope is that this is just a foundation, and down the road, I would love to see the state accept its responsibility as the parent of the individual. So I would encourage your support of the amendment and of the bill in toto, and I think it'll be a great tribute to the people who brought it to our attention.
Thank you, Senator. Questions from the committee for the Senator? No, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Now, Lisa, we will try you again. Guaranteed no one interrupts.
I hate to have interrupted Lisa.
Only allow the important people to interrupt.
Well, at least the elderly.
Yeah, that's right. Yes. So.
Thank you again, Senator Hartung, members of the committee. As I stated, I am an attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project. I represent children and youth in the child welfare and juvenile justice systems. Currently, my clients are ages 3.5 months to 19 years old. In the fiscal year of 1999, in the state of Oregon, approximately 2,000 young people left the custody of the State Office for Services to Children and Families. These children, abused by their and neglected by their biological parents, come into the care of the state. Many of these kids spend more time in foster care than they do with their biological families. As they leave care, many without significant connections to family or community, they struggle to find meaning in their lives. As an attorney for these children, I have seen the obstacles that Oregon's foster children face as they become independent. I have heard a child ask her caseworker when she turned 18 if she could please continue to call her caseworker because her caseworker with SCF was the only adult that she was going to have a connection to, and there were no other people who could provide her with support. I have seen a child pack up her possessions from her foster home in a garbage bag and move to an unsafe situation because that was the only alternative she had to homelessness. I have also seen clients who unfortunately graduated from the foster care system to move on to the criminal justice system. The foster children who do succeed and graduate from high school have already overcome significant odds. Their first success was that they survived abuse and neglect from their biological parents. When they do graduate from high school or get their GED, they have pulled themselves up by their bootstraps in order to do so. The few who do attend college enrich and expand the marketplace of ideas in the colleges and in the universities that they attend. I have heard from youth in foster care that college is often unattainable, not only because of the high cost, but also because these youth often lack a sense of purpose and hope that motivates many other young people. House Bill 2431 will make college attainable not only by providing some financial support, but also because it will serve as a horizon for these foster youth to aim. In the fiscal year of 1999, 61 former foster children applied for a one-time $1,000 scholarship from SCF. Establishing the Former Foster Care Youth Scholarship Fund is the first step. And I would certainly hope that without an appropriation, that private citizens would be able to step forward and come up with the monies necessary to fund it. And I would certainly also hope, I know in this current financial situation that there's not, been told that there's not money for this appropriation, but I would hope that it would be a priority for any ad back that the committee would have.
Thank you very much, Lisa. Could you tell me a little bit, just briefly, what the Juvenile Rights Project does?
Certainly.
What it is?
Certainly. The Juvenile Rights Project is a nonprofit law firm that represents children, both who are in the foster care system and in the juvenile justice system, mainly in Multnomah County, and we serve as attorneys for these children. Mm-hmm. We also have some advocacy projects that we do that enable me to be here today and advocate for legislative changes.
Where do you get your financial help or background?
Well, the financial help for the individual representation of children comes from Indigent Defense. Mm-hmm. And that, since we are a public defender program.
Okay.
The other funds come from other grants and fundraising and things like that.
You don't get any funding from DHS, for instance, Department of Human Services?
We don't get any funding directly from them to represent children in foster care or the child welfare system. We do, as Senator Hartung, you may know from being on the Human Services Subcommittee, that there's currently a settlement agreement between the Juvenile Rights Project and SCF to initiate the system of care reforms. And as part of that, we are required to monitor that implementation and to receive some funding for that monitoring.
Thank you, Lisa. Questions? Senator Moore.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. What is the requested amount of the appropriation?
The requested amount is $150,000.
And you gave the impression that somehow we're short of cash here? But where do you get that impression?
That was my understanding, that it was the direction of the co-chairs that the $150,000 wasn't available.
If you were about to sprinkle 30, 40 million into the children's plan, do you think maybe you could have carved off $150,000 for this program?
Senator Hartung, I'm Senator Miller, it's certainly my hope that $150,000 would be available for very needy children. And I think that $150,000 would go a very, very long way.
Well, I thank you for that, and I think, at least in the Senate, we demonstrated yesterday that cost is no obstacle, and that we're willing to do almost anything to spend money, so I would not give up the fight. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Miller, and We do have an amendment to consider, the dash two amendments, which would take the appropriation out of it, but it could receive private funds and whatnot. So,
well, I don't know why.
Yeah.
Because we're just spending money.
It's too bad you weren't here to hear why. But we will have an opportunity to add back to fulfill your desire of spending more money. Any other questions?
Thank you so much for that nice spin, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Smith.
Is it true that children aged 16 through 21, there are very few of them currently in foster care?
Chair Hartung, Representative Smith, I'm not sure of the exact number of children who are currently in foster care. There's disproportionately fewer teenagers in foster care than there are younger children.
So where would those teenagers be if they're not in foster care?
I think that that's a question that certainly has been asked, and there's been some concern raised that there are children who are not safe and need the intervention.
For that question. Welcome. Please identify
yourself. Thank you, Chair Hartung. My name is Kathy Osborne. I'm a senior attorney at Juvenile Rights Project. Chair Hartung, Representative Smith, one of the problems that we see with juveniles that are in the dependency area, in other words, the abuse and neglect area of the state system, is once they get to be teenagers, a lot of them actually leave the foster care system because the attitude that they have is, I need to take care of myself because nobody else is going to. And what we see is we have a large proportion of 16-year-olds and older dropping out of high school and essentially going out on their own, dropping out of the foster care system, dropping out of high school and going out on their own. Unfortunately, what we see is a lot is these individuals often get back into the state system through through other state grants, either through the welfare system or into the criminal justice system. What our hope is with this bill is by telling these kids, there's a reason for you to graduate from high school, there's a reason for you to get your GED, because if you do, we have money for you to go on to college, that would help stop those kids from dropping out and thinking that they need to go and get a job so that they can support themselves, and that have that idea at 16 years old that they are going to be the only person that's going to help themselves support themselves.
Thank you for that answer. It's not a good answer, but it's the reality of the situation. Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions or comments? Thank you very much. And if we could hear from Carly Davis now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Carly Davis, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much for considering listening to me.
You bet.
First of all,
please identify yourself for the record.
Yes, I'm Carly Davis. I live at 3450 Northwest Circle Boulevard, Corvallis, Oregon. Do you want my telephone number?
Sure.
541-752-8319.
Okay.
I have long had an interest in this particular population. I worked at the farm home. I worked at Corvallis High School. I've worked at a rural high school. I'm well aware of SCF's rules and what the current situation is. Before I talked with all the people that I could get hold of in the local branch of SCF to go over the bill and to go over my proposed amendments. They all were totally in favor of them, and they were totally in favor. They were thrilled with the bill that it was going, and they said that, yes, my realignments are with reality. And that's what I see it as realignments to reflect reality. And I also talked with Don Darland, who is the state chairman of the Foster Care Association, and he also said that this looked like an excellent idea. I heard about this through this article in the Oregonian about saying that it had been introduced by Representative Lane Shatterly, and that Adam Cornell is a survivor of an amazing and very small segment of the population who manages, 12 foster homes. That is absolutely awful, and it should never have happened, but it did, and he survived. I know of only one other really, really big survivor, and that's an author named David Peltzer, who has written 3 books about his life, and he also made it through college and is an author. And at the end of one of his books, he has quotes from all kinds of people that he had contact with, including teachers and social workers, saying how rare his case was. When I talk about realignment, in 1996, the legislature made changes, fundamental changes, in the goals of services to families and children and families. The goal is to implement the best interests of the child, and that's a wonderful realignment because it was, in previous years, the goal was to reunite the family, and often these are very dysfunctional and destructive and dangerous homes. So that is one wonderful thing. The other thing is that ideally children now, by law, are in foster care a maximum of 18 months. And what has happened is that the majority of foster care children come into the system in their 5, 6, 7, 8-year-old range. And the majority of these children who are emotionally healthy enough to be adopted are adopted after the legal termination of the parental rights. And they're usually adopted by their foster family. 70% of those older children are adopted by their foster families. And these families love their kids, but they often do not have a lot of money. And that's a fact. And that's a fact that I checked out with the foster care people and with SDS. And they said, yes, that's certainly true. And this would be a wonderful thing for families who adopt children. And since the case is now that they are supposed to be only in foster care for 18 months, and then a plan is made, and sometimes it's to institutionalize them if they are dangerous and considered unadoptable because of their extreme psychological problems, which might be solved and might not. But there are very few left in the foster care system by the age of 16. And the ones who are there are often the ones who have had to be institutionalized because of severe psychological problems, and they're not the ones that are going to be, there are a few. And ideally it would be wonderful if you could tell these 16-year-olds that are wards of the state still and haven't been in place in a home, that will be enough to say, hey, you're going to get a scholarship, that would be enough to keep them in. But I'm not convinced that that's true. And I think it's a wonderful goal, but the reality is that these younger kids who are going to be, and I know of a family who has 3 adopted children. They were all foster. No, the first 2 were adopted at birth. And this bill is not intended for those kids. I have 2 children who were adopted at birth, and it's totally inappropriate for this bill to be aimed at them. It is aimed at, they have a third child they've adopted who's a third grader, and then they have 2 more foster children in their home who are 8 and 6, who are obviously, these are kids who are survivors. They are going to go to college, and they are really worried about adopting these kids because they said, how can we send 5 kids to college? We can't do it. And these kids need to go. And to me, I want to see the opportunities broaden to these kids who have spent at least 9 months in foster care, and then including the ones who go ahead and are adopted, because that obviously gives them the best shot to get to the place where they will graduate and be eligible for college. Unfortunately, the numbers of kids who will get there and be eligible for college, some of them are limited by their biological parents' behavior of drug and alcohol use during pregnancy, and those kids just are not going to be able to function in college. And I have a 19-year-old that I've had since she was 11, and another high school student.
Ms. Davis, excuse me, we need to get to work session on this. And
all right,
thank you.
But could I just quickly say
certainly.
That I want to realign this so that line 15B, and this is on the second page of this letter that I wrote, a former foster child who has been in the care of services to families and children for at least 9 months during his or her school age years, and that eliminates the kids that are adopted at birth or in the early years, and children who are IRS recognized as foster children be eligible for the above-mentioned scholarships, assuming that those awarded scholarships meet the entrance requirements. The IRS recognizes a small group of people who, like parents and uncles and aunts and brothers and sisters, and it means that the child has been in some kind of big trauma to be out of their biological family and are being raised by another family. And IRS recognized means that they have been in another home for at least one full calendar year. So it's not like they were in there for a month and, hey, they get a scholarship. No, it's these kids are for long-term trauma. And kids who are adopted and at an older age, those parents put out so much financially and emotionally, they need help to get those kids to college. All right, my second amendment is line 12, 6B. Former foster child means an individual who for at least 9 months during their school age years was awarded the court pursuant to ORS 419B.100. Former foster child shall also include children who are United States Internal Revenue recognized as foster children during at least a year of their school age years, 9 months. This is a realignment, in my view, and not an expansion. The other point is that the only children who are still in foster care after the age of 18 are the ones who are on IEPs, which are individual placement programs, educational programs. And those usually are not children who are going to be going to college, and they usually are in permanent foster care if they are still in the foster care system and often institutionalized or in group homes where the hope is that, yeah, keeping them for a couple of more years will give them a more stable entrance into society. But I don't see it as a very costly program at this time because, unfortunately, the number of kids that are going to make it there is not huge. And I wish it were larger, but I think we have to go back to a lot of other issues like drug and alcohol use and women, because I know so many of the kids who are in foster care and then adopted by their foster parents, we can't do anything about that. And they probably won't be with that program. So I strongly, and I also have a letter from probably one of the most experienced and respected of the high school counselors in Corvallis, and that's Diana Mortlock at Crescent Valley. And she said, oh, yeah. Wow, we need this. And everyone I've talked to in the field has said that.
Fine. Thank you, Ms. Davis, very much. We do need to move along, so I'll close the public hearing and move to a work session. And Jim Beyer, I don't think we need to hear from you at this moment. What I'd like to do is, members, is to consider the amendments that we have before you. It's on the yellow sheet. The amendments eliminate the general fund appropriation and allow the former Foster Youth Scholarship Fund to receive appropriations, donations, and grants for the scholarship program. Now, these are amendments that came from Senator Duncan working with the co-chairs, and what I'd like to do is to adopt these amendments. Senator Trowell moves the adoption of the Dash 2 amendments to A.M. Gross House Bill 2431. Is there any objection?
I vote no on that.
You vote what?
No.
Okay. Let the record show that Senator Miller and Representative Smith recorded as no votes. So ordered. And what I would like to do is to move the amended bill to the full committee, and we can still do additional amendments or do add-backs. Is that not right, Steve?
Yeah, there would be an opportunity for add-backs. This bill would go from Ways and Means to the House. It has not been to the House for yet.
Okay, Senator Trowell.
Just a vote explanation, sir. Sure. Chair, I want to see this concept move forward, so I'm glad to have made that motion that you helped me make to move it. But I do want to say that I think this program needs to be improved, and I think it needs to be funded with some general fund dollars if we possibly can find them. And I think also that the amendments that Carly Davis suggested are worthy of consideration not to be put in this bill.
Thank you. Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Miller, and then...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just an inquiry with respect to what the full committee could do. If we had an interest in expanding the category, I'm not sure that can be done at the full. We want to make a substantive change.
Steve, explain that to us.
I believe that Senator Miller is correct. The full committee will typically not consider amendments at that time. What could occur is, again, if this bill is voted out with the A2 amendments out of Ways and Means, the bill would then go through the House, and if approved, the Senate President would assign it to a committee, either a substantive committee that could...
The Senate?
You mean it goes to the Senate?
Yes.
The Senate, I believe.
This originated in the House.
I'm
sorry, this goes to the House floor. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
If the House approves, it would then go to the Senate. The President would then assign the bill. If they did assign it back to Ways and Means, typically Ways and Means would just, since you've already considered it, would just pass it on.
Right.
But we would have the opportunity, again, to bring it back to subcommittee at that time. Yes.
The question I had, Mr. Chairman, is... And maybe, and I apologize if Representative Shetterly testified to it, but it seems to me there could be some additional inspiration to children who are below the age of 16 to be enticed to go to college if this was dangled out there in a pretty small window, in my view. In fact, it would almost make sense in some respects to have the age reduced at both ends, rather than stretching out to 21, bring it down to 18, and make it like a 12 to 18 category or something of that nature, lower. Do I hear 11?
Yeah.
But, well, in any event, that's a concern I wanted to express. I still, based on a lot of things, don't believe that this amount is significant in terms of what we are spending in other programs, and if we really desire to do this, we could do it now.
Right, Representative Smith.
Well, the reason I voted no on the amendments was because with all the money running around this building, I can't believe we can't find $150,000 to ensure that the most needy, but more importantly, the most motivated children in Oregon can get an education. If these kids have made it through what they have made it through and are college-bound in their own mind, to me, that says more motivation than probably this entire panel and their youth put together. You know, I was lucky. I had a good home. And it was always instilled in me to go to college. But these kids don't have that, and they're still willing to go. And I would agree with Senator Miller on reducing the age and put a carrot out there. Because in our school systems now, even in middle school, they talk about kids going to college, and they're preparing them at that time. So let's make this a reality. I would like to do that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. So, members, what I would like to do is have someone make a motion to send the Ian Gross, House Bill 2431, as amended by the dash two amendments to the floor of the House. It will not go to a House committee.
It will go to the full committee, Mr. Chair.
First, the full committee, and then it will go directly to the floor. Do I have a motion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move the Ian Gross, House Bill 2431, as amended here to dash two amendments to the full committee with a two-pass recommendation.
Senator, or Representative Schrader has moved the 2431, the dash two amendments to the full with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this bill is very important, and I supported it in the substantive committee with the money attached, and I'd be happy to support it with the money, but I'm also a realist, and I understand when you say the co-chairs have given us notice that we need to take the money off of it, that maybe we need to do that. And you asked earlier about the add-back process, and I don't totally understand the add-back process, but I'd be very willing to learn it as I track this particular bill, and I will be an aye vote.
Any further discussion? Representative Winters.
Mr. Chair, I would concur with some of the comments that have been made by this panel. $150,000 is paltry when we consider in this building. And I concur with Senator Miller that if we're to try to encourage young people and individuals, that it would be, if there's any way possible, to lower the age.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just ask that, I will vote aye, but when it goes to full ways, it means that we have the discussion there about the, that we really would like to see the dollars put in to this particular bill.
Okay. Other comments or questions? Any objection to sending the amendment? Representative or Senator Miller objects. Okay? And let the record show, and so it will go to the full Ways and Means for the do-pass recommendation. And I'll ask Senator Duncan to carry that to the full Ways and Means since he's on that committee. Yes?
Brief vote explanation, and that is that I think the will of this committee is at least of equal value to two members of the full Ways and Means Committee, and I wish that you had been put into this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, we will close work session on 2431 and open informational hearing by the Department of Education on the coordination of the regional K-12 education services. Department of Education, please come forward. Welcome to the committee. Please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Steve Johnson, Associate Superintendent, Office of Special Education, Oregon Department of Education. This morning we were invited to present information to this committee. We were informed that the information was to be regarding a description of the Early Intervention, Early Childhood Special Education Program, Regional Services Program, and the coordination and support that Regional Services gives to our younger children.
Well, that's correct, Steve. I got a little bit of a difference in what we were going to talk about, but what you have just stated is absolutely correct.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, we assumed it was an abbreviated title.
Yes, right.
Thank you. This morning, Ms. Linda Felber, who is director of our Early Intervention, Early Childhood Special Education Program, and the director of our Regional Services Program, will provide you with information, and then we will respond to your questions. Thank you.
Linda, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, committee. For the record, my name is Linda Felber. I'm director of the Early Intervention, Early Childhood Special Education Programs and also our regional programs. I'd like to tell you a little bit about each of the programs, and then we would be happy to entertain your questions regarding the relationship between the two. In Oregon, approximately 8,466 infants, toddlers, and young children have a disability which causes a delay in their normal development, a delay which, if left unattended or unaddressed, could severely impact them for the rest of their lives. The Early Intervention, Early Childhood Special Education Program is the only program in Oregon with the statutory authority and responsibility to provide special education services to these early intervention, early childhood special education children. The Oregon Department of Education contracts with educational service districts or school districts in order to provide these services, and the department maintains oversight and administration of the program. The department meets monthly with the contractors, and they also provide us with annual service reports and also other annual reports that we require in order to maintain quality and effective services throughout the state. The early intervention, early childhood special education teachers provide instruction in order to assist these young children in their learning opportunities, and these areas of instruction may address cognitive ability, communication areas, motor skills, life skills, and behavioral skills. The early intervention, early childhood special education teachers also provide information and assistance and strategies to parents so that they're able to work with their children at home and make learning a 24-hour opportunity with their children with a disability, just as it is for all the children in the household. Services take place in a variety of settings in order to teach these young children so they are ready to learn when they start school and also to lessen the impact of the disability upon the child. Services are decided on an individual basis, and a team of the family and other service personnel get together to determine what those services would be, and those are written into an individual family service plan. If a child has a low incidence disability at that time, it is very likely that the early intervention, early childhood special education program would utilize the specialized services of the regional program to assist that child. Oregon created a program that is focused on the family and child, and Oregon's vision created a seamless process for our children in terms of the birth to two population, our early intervention program, and our early childhood special education program, which is 3 to 5 year olds. And in conclusion, a great asset to us in the seamless program is that it gives parents an opportunity to interact with the education system at the first possible moment and thus build a strong partnership with education that may carry them into their later school years. Thank you.
Representative Winters?
Yes.
Yeah. In as much as we had a discussion relating to this in your human services sub, please ask and direct some questions that are relevant to what we were talking about couple hours ago.
You're talking about our community resources and how involved is the Department of Education with working with schools in opening those schools up to where parents and the community can become much more an integral part of that system.
The Department of Education and certainly the Early Intervention, Early Childhood Special Education Program would work in concert and support every effort in terms of those centers that would help service children's and family needs within our school, within our school district.
Some of the discussion this morning that we had in Human Services centered on, as you know, the Commission on Children and Families is responsible for working with the communities to help communities to develop integrated service delivery systems and of course, are very highly supportive of community learning centers. There's been a lot of discussion that the and I just might as well say it, that the department has not been a player in some of the local community's work. You know, I know when we were doing Healthy Start and I went to a meeting, all the other agencies was there and the department was not there. And so, you know, it's begged the question is where is education in as we talk about social issues and those service deliveries and its partnership with those within the community, and what does the department plan to do to assure that there is this collaboration and working together in bringing families, whether we're talking early childhood intervention, particularly.
Chair Hartung, Representative Winters, and members of the committee, I'm glad you bring up this question because it is a focus, a real focus point for our early childhood special education community. And I would like to share that within our EIECSE program, we have an entity called the Local Interagency Coordinating Council. And as part of the Local Interagency Coordinating Council, they advise and work with our contractors in terms of developing a service plan and also determining what services on a county level would be needed. And we have these interagency councils in each county. We have members on our local interagency coordinating councils who are, in fact, commission members and members of Healthy Start and Head Start and Migrant Head Start, as well as parents and others. So we look forward within our program and continue to develop our relationships with other communities and with our commission partners as well. We also have at the state level a state interagency coordinating council, and that council reflects very much the same membership of the commission. We have folk there from Head Start, the health division, mental health division, AFS. Gracious, I can't name them all right now, but that is a part of our mandate to look toward the community and our other partners in order to provide a good service to meet the needs of the child, both educationally and in our partnership social, for children who are also socially at risk.
Inside the school building?
In terms of our early intervention, early childhood special education services, that collaboration could take place within a classroom. It could take place in a variety of settings. Wherever the toddler group or whoever the preschool or perhaps the child care setting is, because our services in the program for EIECS may take place in a variety of settings and not just within a classroom. So I'm able to address the concern that you speak to, Representative Winters, in terms of our program. And in terms of the entire Department of Education, I know I speak for the efforts that we are making to be collaborative with our partners.
Yeah, members, before we move along, I'd like Sue to identify a couple of other areas that we were expecting or hoping to have a report from the department about.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, and I'd just like to preface this by saying if there's been any misunderstanding between the department and me on what the purpose of this meeting was for, I'll take full responsibility for that. But because of the proposed $5.5 million cut in the governor's budget in the regional programs, what I wanted you to hear was the relationship between those programs, the ESDs, and including the EIECSE program so that you have a broad overall understanding of how they impact one another, who delivers the services, who exactly the contractors are, what services are provided, and what the impact of the cut would be. So if we could have the department speak to that, I think that would be a benefit to all of you.
All right, Steve, could you do that? Is there someone here from the department that could better do that? Or?
Thank you, Senator Hartung, members of the committee. Thank you, Sue, for clarifying that. In providing services to children with disabilities, the local school district for children between the ages of kindergarten eligibility.
I'm going to interrupt because I think we're supposed to go to floor at 11:30.
Oh.
And so I'm going to ask the department with the committee's indulgence, and if not, that's fine too. You don't have to do it, but we need to get to the point. Do I need information, as does the committee? There's a $5.5 million cut in regional strategies. There is not any general fund to take care of that. There is new federal money coming down, quite a chunk of money that could take care of that. I understand from the department there may be some problems mechanically in taking care of that problem. And I guess we need direction from you. Is it better to try and go through some perhaps convoluted mechanical approaches to fund the regional programs of 5.5, or should we allow each local school district to fend for itself with the flow-through monies that have come from the federal government? So if you could answer that fairly directly, I'd appreciate that, Steve.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, yes, there is a proposed $5.5 million reduction in regional program budgets. Yes, that will increase the burden to school districts, which are responsible for providing all services. They are assisted in providing special education services to certain children through the regional program. Yes, there is an increase in the federal funds coming to Oregon. The great majority, over 95% of those funds, will go directly to school districts through a formula. That still will not address the entire costs of special education. We anticipate that districts, due to the $5.5 million reduction, will have an increased cost beyond the state funds that are coming to them either directly through the basic school support or through the regional program services.
Well, that's really helpful. I appreciate that. So then if I'm asked by my constituents or get letters from the various school districts around the state, I'm going to be able to tell them that the best suggestion from the Department of Education is that given the constraints of the federal dollars or whatever, that it is the Department of Education's direction not to fund back the 5.5 regional programs, but we're going to have to work with that through our individual school districts at this point in time.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, I'm sorry if I gave that impression. We believe that the $5.5 million, if that can be identified and added back from the state fund,
that the general fund, is
from the general fund, that is an important
step. That's not possible?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, if that is not possible, the responsibility remains that of the local school district.
Okay. That's clear.
That provide those services.
Thank you.
Further questions?
I just have one.
Yes.
Because and you indicated that a percentage, 95%, I understand that you stated, and that probably wouldn't be adequate to cover the local needs. Do you have a figure that would supplement that 95% that you discussed, and how much is it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winters, to give you a quick, precise answer on that, I'd like to request, with your permission, that Bob Seward, with the Department of Education, join us at the table and respond to your question.
Certainly. Bob, come forward, please. Welcome to the committee. Proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Seward. I work for the Office of Special Education as the supervisor for the office. As I understand it, the question is what additional general funds may be needed to fulfill the full obligation of excess costs for special education in the state. We do have some figures based on the first report out of the database initiative that gives us a fairly clear picture of the expenditures of both general and federal funds for excess costs for special education for the 99-00 school year. At these figures, given that it is the first year that we've used the DBI to do a full statewide report, suggests that school districts are expending approximately 12% more in general funds than they are receiving through the second weight formula and through the federal funding system that we have of IDEA funds. In general or overall, that's about $46 million more than they're receiving in both general and federal funds statewide.
Mm-hmm. Representative Hobson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I hope Representative Schrader will slap me alongside the head if I'm paraphrasing incorrectly. But I believe that your question was primarily what it would take to make the $5.5 million whole rather than what to assume the total cost of all special ed was.
Regional. Oh.
That pinpoints it a little bit. Because I don't think any of us are offering under the dream world that we'd ever get all of the funding that we would need for that. And if I understood correctly, you're more interested in seeing how to make the 5.5 whole.
That's correct.
Right.
How to make the 5.5 whole. In some way, to make the 5.5 whole, either it appears to me that either $5.5 million is added back to the regional program budget for distribution through regional program services to school districts, or that that $5.5 million appear in funds distributed to school districts in some way so that they could purchase the services that are no longer available through the regional program. And I would say that my estimate would be that, in fact, if we fund those funds to the school districts, that it would exceed $5.5 million due to the efficiencies that we receive through regionalized services, through staffing and a variety of other savings that we receive.
Kind of following up on Representative Hobson's question, be interesting. My understanding is like Portland is a region unto itself, a district unto itself, and then there's others that are a combination of school districts. How would that work? How would the, if we don't are unable to find extra general fund money to restore the 5.5, how would that play out? The money goes through the formula to the each individual school district. How would they change what they're doing now via the regional programs and accommodate their situation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, currently regional programs are not funded at a sufficient level to provide all the services to low-incidence children. Currently, local school districts already contract with their own money for additional regional program services to the 8 contractors or their subcontractors. And just also to clarify, Portland Public School is the contractor for what's called the Columbia Regional Area, which includes districts in Multnomah and Clackamas County.
Additional questions? Senator Troll.
Do we know, do we have some kind of a rundown of what school districts are especially affected and how much they're affected if we don't fund the $5.5 million for the regional programs?
Mr. Chair and Senator Troll, we do have those numbers. I don't have them with me today. I certainly could provide them to you, though.
I think that would be useful for us to see who's being affected and by how much. So I'd like to see that, Mr. Chair. Could we ask them to get us the figures so we can see?
Please do that. Okay, other questions or comments? Steve, anything else you think that we should know in the broad area that we've just talked about?
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. Mr. Chair, members of the committees, one other action that you could take and that you could encourage your colleagues to take, it's not an immediate response, but a long-term response, and that is to continue to urge Congress to fully fund the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act at the level that they promised in 1975, at the level that will support the requirements that they put on your teachers, your administrators, and your parents throughout the state.
Thank you. Representative Schrader?
You mentioned a 95% figure goes through the formulas, and there's 5%. I'd be interested in knowing what that translates into in a dollar figure, the 5%.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, we can also provide that. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Hobson.
A couple of follow-ups, Steve. How many regional centers are there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hobson, there are 8 regional programs, each one as a single contractor, and then may have subcontractors, school districts, ESDs within each region.
Follow-up?
Certainly.
How many school districts does that cover? In other words, how many school districts take advantage of one of the 8 regional programs?
Senator Hertung, Representative Hobson, all school districts that have children with low-incidence disabilities, and that basically is almost every district in the state in any given year.
Yes, follow-up.
to make sure that I understand this, and I thought I did, but I keep learning more, which is great. There is, let's take the $5.5 million is allocated to regional programs, and then school districts contribute to that to serve all the low-incidence kids in the state, presumably. If that 5.5 were not funded, what we're saying is that all 198 school districts in the state would have to backfill that from money that is currently going to something else.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hobson, yes.
Okay. I'm not sure I would agree with that entirely, because there's new federal money that's coming in that I would assume that if I was looking at a $5.5 million cut in regional services program, and heretofore I've been contracting with regional programs, I now am getting new money from the federal government that's going to flow to my school district, which is the preferred Department of Ed approach, and I would use that money to buy the previous regional services on a local level. But what we're hearing here is it's going to be probably slightly more expensive for the school districts to do that, but that does apparently seem to be the preferred option.
Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would assume, Steve, that, again, we're being hypothetical here, that some of the school district would still opt with that flow-through money, as Representative Schrader is indicating, to still support those regional centers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hobson, yes, we believe that that will be the case.
So, yes. Steve, do you have any indication of how much the new federal dollars will be?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winters, yes, we do for this next school year. We thought we did for the second year of the biennium, but those figures are shifting. I'll ask Mr. Siebert to identify the amount that we're aware of for next year.
And Bob, while you're explaining this to us, would you tell us what funds, talking about federal funds now, or not known at the time the governor put his budget together or the co-chairs put their budget together?
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we've been working on projections based on federal government information, which does have a tendency to change periodically. Our best estimate right now is that for the 2001-2002 school year that we will receive above the estimates that are contained in the governor's budget, an additional $800,000 to $900,000, and looking way out in 2002-2003, approximately the same amount, maybe a little bit more. So it may be as much as $1.8 million, $1.9 million, and I believe that I've conveyed that information to Sue and LFO. Now, I've said that, as I had said to Sue, to say to you that these numbers are based on federal government early indicators that there is no hard number here that we can count on.
Okay. Representative Schrader.
I enjoy Representative Hobson's questions, because they raise questions for me to follow up on. And listening to her previous
question. So you're not going to slap her alongside the face?
No, she's good.
Okay.
Theoretically, districts would have the option of still contracting with regional programs. What if there's not enough school districts that opt to do the regional program approach, and it's an unsustainable program because there's not enough people going that route, as opposed to most of them decide to try and do it on their own? Therefore, some districts in Paisley or Vernonia don't have service.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, the total regional program in the state will probably and will continue at a certain level of service, and they will continue to offer certain services. If some school districts choose not to contract back for the unfunded services that regional programs used to provide, we will work cooperatively with those districts, with the regional programs, and with the parents whose children are receiving those services, to determine what is an orderly and proper construction for the regional programs, and how any reduction in their services and in their staff can be done in a way that minimizes any hurt or potential danger for children.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A comment, if I could. I can tell you what Vernonia would do with their kids. They would be able to serve them, which is problematic. In regard to the money, I'm a little confused. I have been looking at a figure much higher than $800,000 I mean, looking at millions rather than, so this is a bit of shock to me.
I had, Mr. Chair, Representative Hobson, I too had a moment of panic there until I realized that what Mr. Seward was identifying was the money in addition to the money reflected in the governor's budget. Mm-hmm. I would ask him now to identify the new federal funds, if he has that information, the new federal funds from IDEA in addition to those that were received in this biennium. Then
okay.
We will hear the word million.
Yeah, right. I'm sorry, I believe that I understood that you were talking about just the regional dollars.
So going back to my question then, if the 5.5 million and then you take the new money, which is about 1.9 or 1.8, then the whole then becomes 5.5 minus 1.9.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winters, yes, that's true. If that additional money is used by districts for the regional program services, but we need to remember that districts have many other children with other disabilities, and the services that those children require, they add up to that $46 million that Mr. Seward mentioned that's costing districts in addition to the income that they receive.
But we started with the question of what if we were not successful in getting the 5.5 million that the governor cut. And so looking at the what if question and looking at other possibilities that would reduce that amount, so that should we be able to maybe come part way or some way, you know, and it's looking at how can we fill the hole.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winters, yes, that's very accurate, and we appreciate this flexibility and this attempt to find as many sources as we can. Thank you.
Steve, we're going to have to adjourn because the House goes to the floor, but question I really didn't get to ask, and it's not clear in my mind, the relationship between the regional programs and the ESD programs, how resolutions from the ESD to school districts might or might not be affected. So is there some way you could get that to us in writing so that we could, and if you don't understand the detail of the question, please talk to Sue about it, because we have talked about that. If there's no other business to come, we are adjourned, and no meeting tomorrow, members.